title of patrician, and afterwards the singular name of Catapan was assigned to the supreme governor, and the policy both of the church and state was modelled in exact subordination to the throne of Constantinople. As long as the scepter was disputed by the princes of Italy, their efforts were feeble and adverse. Then the Greeks resisted or eluded the forces of Germany, which descended from the Alps under the imperial standard of the Otters. The first and greatest of those Saxon princes was compelled to relinquish the siege of Bari. The second, after the loss of his stoutest bishops and barons, escaped with honour from the bloody field of Crotona. On that day the scale of war was turned against the Franks by the valour of the Saracens. These corsairs had indeed been driven by the Byzantine fleets from the fortresses and coasts of Italy, but a sense of interest was more prevalent than superstition or resentment, and the Caliph of Egypt had transported 40,000 Muslims to the aid of his Christian ally. The successors of Basil amused themselves with the belief that the conquest of Lombardy had been achieved and was still preserved by the justice of their laws, the virtues of their ministers, and the gratitude of a people whom they had rescued from anarchy and oppression. A series of rebellions might dart a ray of truth into the palace of Constantinople, and the illusions of flattery were dispelled by the easy and rapid success of the Norman adventurers. The revolution of human affairs had produced in Apulia and Calabria a melancholy contrast between the age of Pythagoras and the 10th century of the Christian era. At the former period, the coast of Great Greece, as it was then styled, was planted with free and opulent cities. These cities were peopled with soldiers, artists, and philosophers, and the military strength of Tarentum, Sybaris, or Crotona was not inferior to that of a powerful kingdom. At the second era, these once flourishing provinces were clouded with ignorance, impoverished by tyranny, and depopulated by barbarian war. Nor can we severely accuse the exaggeration of a contemporary that a fair and ample district was reduced to the same desolation which had covered the earth after the general deluge. Among the hostilities of the Arabs, the Franks, and the Greeks in southern Italy, I shall select two or three anecdotes expressive of their national manners. It was the amusement of the Saracens to profane, as well as to pillage, the monasteries and churches. At the siege of Salerno, a Muslim chief spread his couch on the communion table, and on that altar sacrificed each night the virginity of a Christian nun. As he wrestled with a reluctant maid, a beam in the roof was accidentally or dexterously thrown down on his head, and the death of the lustful emir was imputed to the wrath of Christ, which was at length awakened to the defense of his faithful spouse. The Saracens besieged the cities of Beneventum and Capua. After a vain appeal to the successors of Charlemagne, the Lombards implored the clemency and aid of the Greek emperor. A fearless citizen dropped from the walls, passed the entrenchments, accomplished his commission, and fell into the hands of the barbarians as he was returning with the welcome news. They commanded him to assist their enterprise and deceive his countrymen with the assurance that wealth and honors should be the reward of his falsehood, and that his sincerity would be punished with immediate death. He affected to yield, but as soon as he was conducted within hearing of the Christians on the rampart, "Friends and brethren," he cried with a loud voice, "be bold and patient. Maintain the city. Your sovereign is informed of your distress, and your deliverers are at hand. I know my doom, and commit my wife and children to your gratitude." The rage of the Arabs confirmed his evidence, and the self-devoted patriot was transpierced with 100 spears. He deserves to live in the memory of the virtuous, but the repetition of the same story in ancient and modern times may sprinkle some doubts on the reality of this generous deed. The recital of a third incident may provoke a smile amidst the horrors of war. Theobald, Marquis of Camerino and Spoleto, supported the rebels of Beneventum, and his wanton cruelty was not incompatible in that age with the character of a hero. His captives of the Greek nation or party were castrated without mercy, and the outrage was aggravated by a cruel jest that he wished to present the emperor with a supply of eunuchs, the most precious ornaments of the Byzantine court. The garrison of a castle had been defeated in a sally, and the prisoners were sentenced to the customary operation. But the sacrifice was disturbed by the intrusion of a frantic female who, with bleeding cheeks, disheveled hair, and importunate clamours, compelled the Marquis to listen to her complaint. "Is it thus," she cried, "ye magnanimous heroes, that ye wage war against women who have never injured ye, and whose only arms are the distaff and the loom?" Theobald denied the charge and protested that, since the Amazons, he had never heard of a female war. "And how," she furiously exclaimed, "can you attack us more directly, how can you wound us in a more vital part, than by robbing our husbands of what we most dearly cherish, the source of our joys and the hope of our posterity? The plunder of our flocks and herds I have endured without a murmur, but this fatal injury, this irreparable loss, subdues my patience and calls aloud on the justice of heaven and earth." A general laugh applauded her eloquence. The savage Franks, inaccessible to pity, were moved by her ridiculous yet rational despair. And with the deliverance of the captives, she obtained the restitution of her effects. As she returned in triumph to the castle, she was overtaken by a messenger to inquire in the name of Theobald what punishment should be inflicted on her husband were he again taken in arms. "Should such," she answered without hesitation, "be his guilt and misfortune, he has eyes and a nose and hands and feet. These are his own, and these he may deserve to forfeit by his personal offences. But let my lord be pleased to spare what his little handmaid presumes to claim as her peculiar and lawful property." The establishment of the Normans in the kingdoms of Naples and Sicily is an event most romantic in its origin, and in its consequences most important both to Italy and the Eastern Empire. The broken provinces of the Greeks, Lombards, and Saracens were exposed to every invader, and every sea and land were invaded by the adventurous spirit of the Scandinavian pirates. After a long indulgence of rapine and slaughter, a fair and ample territory was accepted, occupied, and named by the Normans of France. They renounced their gods for the God of the Christians, and the dukes of Normandy acknowledged themselves the vassals of the successors of Charlemagne and Capet. The savage fierceness which they had brought from the snowy mountains of Norway was refined, without being corrupted in a warmer climate. The companions of Rollo insensibly mingled with the natives. They imbibed the manners, language, and gallantry of the French nation. And in a martial age, the Normans might claim the palm of valor and glorious achievements. Of the fashionable superstitions, they embraced with ardor the pilgrimages of Rome, Italy, and the Holy Land. In this active devotion, the minds and bodies were invigorated by exercise. Danger was the incentive, novelty the recompense. And the prospect of the world was decorated by wonder, credulity, and ambitious hope. They confederated for their mutual defense, and the robbers of the Alps, who had been allured by the garb of a pilgrim, were often chastised by the arm of a warrior. In one of these pious visits to the cavern of Mount Garganus in Apulia, which had been sanctified by the apparition of the Archangel Michael, they were accosted by a stranger in the Greek habit, but who soon revealed himself as a rebel, a fugitive, and a mortal foe of the Greek Empire. His name was Milo, a noble citizen of Bari, who, after an unsuccessful revolt, was compelled to seek new allies and avengers of his country. The bold appearance of the Normans revived his hopes and solicited his confidence. They listened to the complaints and still more to the promises of the patriot. The assurance of wealth demonstrated the justice of his cause, and they viewed as the inheritance of the brave the fruitful land which was oppressed by effeminate tyrants. On their return to Normandy, they kindled a spark of enterprise, and a small but intrepid band was freely associated for the deliverance of Apulia. They passed the Alps by separate roads and in the disguise of pilgrims, but in the neighborhood of Rome they were saluted by the chief of Bari, who supplied the more indigent with arms and horses and instantly led them to the field of action. In the first conflict their valor prevailed, but in the second engagement they were overwhelmed by the numbers and military engines of the Greeks, and indignantly retreated with their faces to the enemy. The unfortunate Milo ended his life a suppliant at the court of Germany. His Norman followers, excluded from their native and their promised land, wandered among the hills and valleys of Italy and earned their daily subsistence by the sword. To that formidable sword the princes of Capua, Beneventum, Salerno, and Naples alternately appealed in their domestic quarrels. The superior spirit and discipline of the Normans gave victory to the side which they espoused, and their cautious policy observed the balance of power, lest the preponderance of any rival state should render their aid less important and their service less profitable. Their first asylum was a strong camp in the depth of the marshes of Campania, but they were soon endowed by the liberality of the Duke of Naples with a more plentiful and permanent seat. 8 miles from his residence, as a bulwark against Capua, the town of Aversa was built and fortified for their use, and they enjoyed as their own the corn and fruits, the meadows and groves of that fertile district. The report of their success attracted every year new swarms of pilgrims and soldiers. The poor were urged by necessity, the rich were excited by hope, and the brave and active spirits of Normandy were impatient of ease and ambitious of renown. The independent standard of Aversa afforded shelter and encouragement to the outlaws of the province, to every fugitive who had escaped from the injustice or justice of his superiors, and these foreign associates were quickly assimilated in manners and language to the Gallic colony. The first leader of the Normans was Count Rainulf, and in the origin of society, preeminence of rank is the reward and the proof of superior merit. Since the conquest of Sicily by the Arabs, the Grecian emperors had been anxious to regain that valuable possession. But their efforts, however strenuous, had been opposed by the distance and the sea. Their costly armaments, after a gleam of success, added new pages of calamity and disgrace to the Byzantine annals. 20,000 of their best troops were lost in a single expedition, and the victorious Muslims derided the policy of a nation which entrusted eunuchs not only with the custody of their women, but with the command of their men. After a reign of 200 years, the Saracens were ruined by their divisions. The emir disclaimed the authority of the king of Tunis. The people rose against the emir. The cities were usurped by the chiefs. Each meaner rebel was independent in his village or castle, and the weaker of two rival brothers implored the friendship of the Christians. In every service of danger, the Normans were prompt and useful, and 500 knights or warriors on horseback were enrolled by Arduin, the agent and interpreter of the Greeks, under the standard of Maniakes, governor of Lombardy. Before their landing, the brothers were reconciled. The union of Sicily and Africa was restored, and the island was guarded to the water's edge. The Normans led the van, and the Arabs of Messina felt the valor of an untried foe. In a second action, the emir of Syracuse was unhorsed and transpierced by the iron arm of William of Hauteville. In a third engagement, his intrepid companions discomfited the host of 60,000 Saracens and left the Greeks no more than the labor of the pursuit. A splendid victory, but of which the pen of the historian may divide the merit with the lance of the Normans. It is, however, true that they essentially promoted the success of Maniakes, who reduced 13 cities and the greater part of Sicily under the obedience of the emperor. But his military fame was sullied by ingratitude and tyranny. In the division of the spoils, the deserts of his brave auxiliaries were forgotten, and neither their avarice nor their pride could brook this injurious treatment. They complained by the mouth of their interpreter. Their complaint was disregarded. Their interpreter was scourged. The sufferings were his. The insult and resentment belonged to those whose sentiments he had delivered. Yet they dissembled till they had obtained, or stolen, a safe passage to the Italian continent. Their brethren of Aversa sympathized in their indignation, and the province of Apulia was invaded as the forfeit of the debt. Above 20 years after the first emigration, the Normans took the field with no more than 700 horse and 500 foot, and after the recall of the Byzantine legions from the Sicilian War, their numbers are magnified to the amount of 60,000 men. Their herald proposed the option of battle or retreat. "Of battle," was the unanimous cry of the Normans. And one of their stoutest warriors, with a stroke of his fist, felled to the ground the horse of the Greek messenger. He was dismissed with a fresh horse. The insult was concealed from the imperial troops, but in two successive battles they were more fatally instructed of the prowess of their adversaries. In the plains of Cannae, the Asiatics fled before the adventurers of France. The Duke of Lombardy was made prisoner. The Apulians acquiesced in a new dominion, and the four places of Bari, Otranto, Brundusium, and Tarentum were alone saved in the shipwreck of the Grecian fortunes. From this area we may date the establishment of the Norman power, which soon eclipsed the infant colony of Aversa. 12 counts were chosen by the popular suffrage, and age, birth, and merit were the motives of their choice. The tributes of their peculiar districts were appropriated to their use, and each count erected a fortress in the midst of his lands, and at the head of his vassals. In the center of the province, the common habitation of Melfi was reserved as the metropolis and citadel of the republic. A house and separate quarter was allotted to each of the 12 counts, and the national concerns were regulated by this military senate. The first of his peers, their president and general, was entitled Count of Apulia, and this dignity was conferred on William of the Iron Arm, who in the language of the age is styled a lion in battle, a lamb in society, and an angel in council. The manners of his countrymen are fairly delineated by a contemporary and national historian. "The Normans," says Malaterra, "are a cunning and revengeful people. Eloquence and dissimulation appear to be their hereditary qualities. They can stoop to flatter, but unless they are curbed by the restraint of law, they indulge the licentiousness of nature and passion. Their princes affect the praises of popular munificence. The people observe the medium, or rather blend the extremes of avarice and prodigality, and in their eager thirst of wealth and dominion they despise whatever they possess and hope whatever they desire. Arms and horses, the luxury of dress, the exercises of hunting and hawking are the delight of the Normans, but on pressing occasions they can endure with incredible patience the inclemency of every climate and the toil and absence of a military life." The Normans of Apulia were seated on the verge of the two empires, and according to the policy of the hour, they accepted the investiture of their lands from the sovereigns of Germany or Constantinople. But the firmest title of these adventurers was the right of conquest. They neither loved nor trusted. They were neither trusted nor beloved. The contempt of the princes was mixed with fear, and the fear of the natives was mingled with hatred and resentment. Every object of desire, a horse, a woman, a garden, tempted and gratified the rapaciousness of the strangers, and the avarice of their chiefs was only coloured by the more specious names of ambition and glory. The 12 counts were sometimes joined in the league of injustice. In their domestic quarrels they disputed the spoils of the people. The virtues of William were buried in his grave, and Drogo, his brother and successor, was better qualified to lead the valour than to restrain the violence of his peers. Under the reign of Constantine Monomachus, the policy, rather than benevolence, of the Byzantine court attempted to relieve Italy from this adherent mischief, more grievous than a flight of barbarians. And Argyrus, the son of Milo, was invested for this purpose with the most lofty titles and the most ample commission. The memory of his father might recommend him to the Normans, and he had already engaged their voluntary service to quell the revolt of Maniaces, and to revenge their own and the public injury. It was the design of Constantine to transplant the warlike colony from the Italian provinces to the Persian War, and the son of Milo distributed among the chiefs the gold and manufactures of Greece as the first fruits of the imperial bounty. But his hearts were baffled by the sense and spirit of the conquerors of Apulia. His gifts, or at least his proposals, were rejected, and they unanimously refused to relinquish their possessions and their hopes for the distant prospect of Asiatic fortune. After the means of persuasion had failed, Argyrus resolved to compel or to destroy. The Latin powers were solicited against the common enemy, and an offensive alliance was formed of the Pope and the two emperors of the East and West. The throne of St. Peter was occupied by Leo the Ninth, a simple saint, of a temper most apt to deceive himself and the world, and whose venerable character would consecrate with the name of piety the measures least compatible with the practice of religion. His humanity was affected by the complaints, perhaps the calumnies, of an injured people. The impious Normans had interrupted the payment of tithes, and the temporal sword might be lawfully unsheathed against these sacrilegious robbers who are deaf to the censures of the Church. As a German of noble birth and royal kindred, Leo had free access to the court and confidence of the Emperor Henry III, and in search of arms and allies, his ardent zeal transported him from Apulia to Saxony, from the Elbe to the Tiber. During these hostile preparations, Argyrus indulged himself in the use of secret and guilty weapons. A crowd of Normans became the victims of public or private revenge, and the valiant Drogo was murdered in a church. But his spirit survived in his brother Humphrey, the third Count of Apulia. The assassins were chastised, and the son of Milo, overthrown and wounded, was driven from the field to hide his shame behind the walls of Bari and to await the tardy succor of his allies. But the power of Constantine was distracted by Turkish war. The mind of Henry was feeble and irresolute, and the Pope, instead of repassing the Alps with a German army, was accompanied only by a guard of 700 Swabians and some volunteers of Lorraine. In his long progress from Mantua to Beneventum, a vile and promiscuous multitude of Italians was enlisted under the holy standard. The priest and the robber slept in the same tent. The pikes and crosses were intermingled in the front, and the martial saint repeated the lessons of his youth in the order of march, of encampment, and of combat. The Normans of Apulia could muster in the field no more than 3,000 horse, with a handful of infantry. The defection of the natives intercepted their provisions and retreat, and their spirit, incapable of fear, was chilled for a moment by superstitious awe. On the hostile approach of Leo, they knelt, without disgrace or reluctance, before their spiritual father. But the Pope was inexorable. His lofty Germans affected to deride the diminutive stature of their adversaries, and the Normans were informed that death or exile was their only alternative. Flight they disdained, and as many of them had been 3 days without tasting food, they embraced the assurance of a more easy and honorable death. They climbed the hill of Civitella, descended into the plain, and charged in 3 divisions the army of the Pope. On the left and in the center, Richard, Count of Aversa, and Robert, the famous Giscard, attacked, broke, routed, and pursued the Italian multitudes, who fought without discipline and fled without shame. A hardier trial was reserved for the valor of Count Humphrey, who led the cavalry of the right wing. The Germans have been described as unskillful in the management of the horse and the lance, but on foot they formed a strong and impenetrable phalanx, and neither man nor steed nor armor could resist the weight of their long and two-handed swords. After a severe conflict, they were encompassed by the squadrons returning from the pursuit, and died in the ranks with the esteem of their foes and the satisfaction of revenge. The gates of Civitella were shut against the flying Pope, and he was overtaken by the pious conquerors, who kissed his feet to implore his blessing and the absolution of their sinful victory. The soldiers beheld in their enemy and captive the Vicar of Christ, and though we may suppose the policy of the chiefs, it is probable that they were infected by the popular superstition. In the calm of retirement, the well-meaning Pope deplored the effusion of Christian blood, which must be imputed to his account. He felt that he had been the author of sin and scandal, and as his undertaking had failed, the indecency of his military character was universally condemned. With these dispositions, he listened to the offers of a beneficial treaty, deserted an alliance which he had preached as the cause of God, and ratified the past and future conquests of the Normans. By whatever hands they had been usurped, the provinces of Apulia and Calabria were a part of the donation of Constantine and the patrimony of St. Peter. The grant and the acceptance confirmed the mutual claims of the pontiff and the adventurers. They promised to support each other with spiritual and temporal arms. A tribute or quitrent of 12 pence was afterwards stipulated for every ploughland, and since this memorable transaction, the kingdom of Naples has remained above 700 years a fief of the Holy See. The pedigree of Robert of Giscard is variously deduced from the peasants and the dukes of Normandy, from the peasants by the pride and ignorance of a Grecian princess, from the dukes by the ignorance and flattery of the Italian subjects. His genuine descent may be ascribed to the second or middle order of private nobility. He sprang from a race of Valvasors or Bannerets, of the diocese of Coutances in the lower Normandy. The castle of Horville was their honorable seat. His father, Tancred, was conspicuous in the court and army of the duke, and his military service was furnished by 10 soldiers or knights. 2 marriages, of a rank not unworthy of his own, made him the father of 12 sons, who were educated at home by the impartial tenderness of his second wife. But a narrow patrimony was insufficient for this numerous and daring progeny. They saw around the neighborhood the mischiefs of poverty and discord, and resolved to seek in foreign wars a more glorious inheritance. 2 only remained to perpetuate the race and cherish their father's age. Their 10 brothers, as they successfully attained the vigor of manhood, departed from the castle, passed the Alps, and joined the Apulian camp of the Normans. The elder were prompted by native spirit. Their success encouraged their younger brethren, and the 3 first in seniority, William, Drogo, and Humphrey, deserved to be the chiefs of their nation and the founders of the new republic. Robert was the eldest of the 7 sons of the second marriage, and even the reluctant praise of his foes has endowed him with the heroic qualities of a soldier and a statesman. His lofty stature surpassed the tallest of his army. His limbs were cast in the true proportion of strength and gracefulness, and to the decline of life he maintained the patient vigor of health and the commanding dignity of his form. His complexion was ruddy, his shoulders were broad, his hair and beard were long and of a flaxen color. His eyes sparkled with fire, and his voice, like that of Achilles, could impress obedience and terror amidst the tumult of battle. In the ruder ages of chivalry, such qualifications are not below the notice of the poet or historians. They may observe that Robert, at once and with equal dexterity, could wield in the right hand his sword, his lance in the left, that in the Battle of Civitella he was thrice unhorsed, and that in the close of that memorable day he was adjudged to have borne away the prize of valor from the warriors of the two armies. His boundless ambition was founded on the consciousness of superior worth. In the pursuit of greatness, he was never arrested by the scruples of justice, and seldom moved by the feelings of humanity. Though not insensible of fame, the choice of open or clandestine means was determined only by his present advantage. The surname of Giscard was applied to this master of political wisdom, which is too often confounded with the practice of dissimulation and deceit. And Robert is praised by the Apulian poet for excelling the cunning of Ulysses and the eloquence of Cicero. Yet these arts were disguised by an appearance of military frankness. In his highest fortune he was accessible and courteous to his fellow soldiers, and while he indulged the prejudices of his new subjects, he affected in his dress and manners to maintain the ancient fashion of his country. He grasped with a rapacious, that he might distribute, with a liberal hand. His primitive indigence had taught the habits of frugality. The gain of a merchant was not below his attention, and his prisoners were tortured with slow and unfeeling cruelty to force a discovery of their secret treasure. According to the Greeks, he departed from Normandy with only 5 followers on horseback and 30 on foot. Yet even this allowance appears too bountiful. The 6th son of Tancred of Hauteville passed the Alps as a pilgrim, and his first military band was levied among the adventurers of Italy. His brothers and countrymen had divided the fertile lands of Apulia, but they guarded their shares with the jealousy of avarice. The aspiring youth was driven forwards to the mountains of Calabria, and in his first exploits against the Greeks and the natives, it is not easy to discriminate the hero from the robber. To surprise a castle or a convent, to ensnare a wealthy citizen, to plunder the adjacent villages for necessary food, were the obscure labors which formed and exercised the powers of his mind and body. The volunteers of Normandy adhered to his standard, and under his command, the peasants of Calabria assumed the name and character of Normans. As the genius of Robert expanded with his fortune, he awakened the jealousy of his elder brother, by whom, in a transient quarrel, his life was threatened and his liberty restrained. After the death of Humphrey, the tender age of his sons excluded them from the command. They were reduced to a private estate by the ambition of their guardian and uncle, and Giscard was exalted on a buckler and saluted Count of Apulia and General of the Republic. With an increase of authority and of force, he resumed the conquest of Calabria, and soon aspired to a rank that should raise him forever above the heads of his equals. By some acts of rapine or sacrilege, he had incurred a papal excommunication, but Nicholas II was easily persuaded that the division of friends could terminate only in their mutual prejudice, that the Normans were the faithful champions of the Holy See, and it was safer to trust the alliance of a prince than the caprice of an aristocracy. a synod of 100 bishops was convened at Melfi, and the count interrupted an important enterprise to guard the person and execute the decrees of the Roman pontiff. His gratitude and policy conferred on Robert and his posterity the ducal title, with the investiture of Apulia, Calabria, and all the lands, both in Italy and Sicily, which his sword could rescue from the schismatic Greeks and the unbelieving Saracens. This apostolic sanction might justify his arms, but the obedience of a free and victorious people could not be transferred without their consent, and Giscard dissembled his elevation till the ensuing campaign had been illustrated by the conquest of Cosenza and Reggio. In the hour of triumph he assembled his troops and solicited the Normans to confirm by their suffrage the judgment of the Vicar of Christ. The soldiers hailed with joyful acclamations their valiant duke, and the counts, his former equals, pronounced the oath of fidelity with hollow smiles and secret indignation. After this inauguration, Robert styled himself, by the grace of God in St. Peter, Duke of Apulia, Calabria, and hereafter of Sicily. And it was the labor of 20 years to deserve and realize these lofty appellations. Such tardy progress in a narrow space may seem unworthy of the abilities of the chief and the spirit of the nation. But the Normans were few in number. Their resources were scanty. Their service was voluntary and precarious. The bravest designs of the Duke were sometimes opposed by the free voice of his parliament of barons. The 12 counts of popular election conspired against his authority, and against their perfidious uncle, the sons of Humphrey, demanded justice and revenge. By his policy and vigor, Giscard discovered their plots, suppressed their rebellions, and punished the guilty with death or exile. But in these domestic feuds, his years and the national strength were unprofitably consumed. After the defeat of his foreign enemies, the Greeks, Lombards, and Saracens, their broken forces retreated to the strong and populous cities of the seacoast. They excelled in the arts of fortification and defense. The Normans were accustomed to serve on horseback in the field, and their rude attempts could only succeed by the efforts of persevering courage. The resistance of Salerno was maintained above 8 months. The siege or blockade of Bari lasted near 4 years. In these actions, the Norman Duke was the foremost in every danger, in every fatigue the last and most patient. As he pressed the citadel of Salerno, a huge stone from the rampart shattered one of his military engines, and by a splinter he was wounded in the breast. Before the gates of Bari, he lodged in a miserable hut or barrack composed of dry branches and thatched with straw. A perilous station on all sides, open to the inclemency of the winter and the spears of the enemy. The Italian conquests of Robert correspond with the limits of the present kingdom of Naples, and the countries united by his arms have not been dissevered by the revolutions of 700 years. The monarchy has been composed of the Greek provinces of Calabria and Apulia, of the Lombard principality of Salerno, the Republic of Amalfi, and the inland dependencies of the large and ancient duchy of Beneventum. 3 districts only were exempted from the common law of subjection, the first forever, the 2 last till the middle of the succeeding century. The city and immediate territory of Benevento had been transferred, by gift or exchange, from the German emperor to the Roman pontiff, and although this holy land was sometimes invaded, the name of St. Peter was finally more potent than the sword of the Normans. The first colony of Aversa subdued and held the state of Capua, and her princes were reduced to beg their bread before the palace of their fathers. The Dukes of Naples, the present metropolis, maintained the popular freedom under the shadow of the Byzantine Empire. Among the new acquisitions of Giscard, The science of Salerno and the trade of Amalfi may detain for a moment the curiosity of the reader. Of the learned faculties, jurisprudence implies the previous establishment of laws and property, and theology may perhaps be superseded by the full light of religion and reason. But the savage and the sage alike must implore the assistance of physic, and if our diseases are inflamed by luxury, the mischiefs of blows and wounds would be more frequent in the ruder ages of society. The treasures of Grecian medicine had been communicated to the Arabian colonies of Africa, Spain, and Sicily, and in the intercourse of peace and war, a spark of knowledge had been kindled and cherished at Salerno, an illustrious city in which the men were honest and the women beautiful. A school, the first that arose in the darkness of Europe, was consecrated to the healing art. The conscience of monks and bishops was reconciled to that salutary and lucrative profession, and a crowd of patients of the most eminent rank and most distant climates invited or visited the physicians of Salerno. They were protected by the Norman conquerors, and Giscard, though bred in arms, could discern the merit and value of a philosopher. After a pilgrimage of 39 years, Constantine, an African Christian, returned from Baghdad a master of the language and learning of the Arabians, and Salerno was enriched by the practice, the lessons, and the writings of the pupil of Avicenna. The school of medicine has long slept in the name of a university, but her precepts are abridged in a string of aphorisms bound together with the Leonine verses or Latin rhymes of the 12th century. 7 miles to the west of Salerno and 30 to the south of Naples, the obscure town of Amalfi displayed the power and rewards of industry. The land, however fertile, was of narrow extent, but the sea was accessible and open. The inhabitants first assumed the office of supplying the Western world with the manufactures and productions of the East, and this useful traffic was the source of their opulence and freedom. The government was popular under the administration of a duke and the supremacy of the Greek emperor. 50,000 citizens were numbered in the walls of Amalfi. Nor was any city more abundantly provided with gold, silver, and the objects of precious luxury. The mariners who swarmed in her port excelled in the theory and practice of navigation and astronomy, and the discovery of the compass, which has opened the globe, is owing to their ingenuity or good fortune. Their trade was extended to the coasts, or at least to the commodities of Africa, Arabia, and India, and their settlements in Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria acquired the privileges of independent colonies. After 300 years of prosperity, Amalfi was oppressed by the arms of the Normans and sacked by the jealousy of Pisa. But the poverty of 1,000 fishermen is yet dignified by the remains of an arsenal, a cathedral, and the palaces of royal merchants. Roger, the 12th and last of the sons of Tancred, had been long detained in Normandy by his own and his father's age. He accepted the welcome summons, hastened to the Apulian camp, and deserved at first the esteem and afterwards the envy of his elder brother. Their valor and ambition were equal, but the youth, the beauty, the elegant manners of Roger engaged the disinterested love of the soldiers and people. So scanty was his allowance for himself and 40 followers that he descended from conquest to robbery, and from robbery to domestic theft, and so loose were the notions of property that by his own historian, at his special command, he is accused of stealing horses from a stable at Melfi. His spirit emerged from poverty and disgrace. From these base practices, he rose to the merit and glory of a holy war, and the invasion of Sicily was seconded by the zeal and policy of his brother Giscard. After the retreat of the Greeks, the idolaters, a most audacious reproach of the Catholics, had retrieved their losses and possessions. But the deliverance of the island, so vainly undertaken by the forces of the Eastern Empire, was achieved by a small and private band of adventurers. In the first attempt, Roger braved in an open boat the real and fabulous dangers of Scylla and Charybdis, landed with only 60 soldiers on a hostile shore, drove the Saracens to the gates of Messina, and safely returned with the spoils of the adjacent country. In the fortress of Trani, his active and patient courage were equally conspicuous. In his old age he related with pleasure that, by the distress of the siege, himself and the countess his wife had been reduced to a single cloak or mantle, which they wore alternately. That in a sally his horse had been slain, and he was dragged away by the Saracens, but that he owed his rescue to his good sword, and had retreated with his saddle on his back, lest the meanest trophy might be left in the hands of the miscreants. In the siege of Trani, 300 Normans withstood and repulsed the forces of the island. In the field of Ceramio, 50,000 horse and foot were overthrown by 136 Christian soldiers, without reckoning St. George, who fought on horseback in the foremost ranks. The captive banners with 4 camels were reserved for the successor of St. Peter, and had these barbaric spoils been exposed, not in the Vatican, but in the capital, they might have revived the memory of the Punic triumphs. These insufficient numbers of the Normans most probably denote their knights, the soldiers of honorable and equestrian rank, each of whom was attended by 5 or 6 followers in the field. Yet with the aid of this interpretation, and after every fair allowance on the side of valor, arms, and reputation, the discomfiture of so many myriads will reduce the prudent reader to the alternative of a miracle or a fable. The Arabs of Sicily derived a frequent and powerful succor from their countrymen of Africa. In the siege of Palermo, the Norman cavalry was assisted by the galleys of Pisa, and in the hour of action, the envy of the two brothers was sublimed to a generous and invincible emulation. After a war of 30 years, Roger, with the title of Great Count, obtained the sovereignty of the largest and most fruitful island of the Mediterranean, and his administration displays a liberal and enlightened mind, above the limits of his age and education. The Muslims were maintained in the free enjoyment of their religion and property. A philosopher and physician of Mazara, of the race of Mohammed, harangued the conqueror, and was invited to court. His geography of the 7 climates was translated into Latin, and Roger, after a diligent perusal, preferred the work of the Arabian to the writings of the Grecian Ptolemy. A remnant of Christian natives had promoted the success of the Normans. They were rewarded by the triumph of the cross. The island was restored to the jurisdiction of the Roman pontiff. New bishops were planted in the principal cities, and the clergy were satisfied by liberal endowment of churches and monasteries. Yet the Catholic hero asserted the rights of the civil magistrate. Instead of resigning the investiture of benefices, he dexterously applied to his own profit the papal claims. The supremacy of the crown was secured and enlarged by the singular bull, which declares the princes of Sicily hereditary and perpetual legates of the Holy See. To Robert Guiscard, the conquest of Sicily was more glorious than beneficial. The possession of Apulia and Calabria was inadequate to his ambition, and he resolved to embrace or create the first occasion of invading, perhaps of subduing, the Roman Empire of the East. From his first wife, the partner of his humble fortune, he had been divorced under the pretense of consanguinity, and her son, Bohemond, was destined to imitate rather than to succeed his illustrious father. The second wife of Guiscard was the daughter of the princes of Salerno. The Lombards acquiesced in the lineal succession of their son Roger. Their 5 daughters were given in honorable nuptials, and one of them was betrothed in a tender age to Constantine, a beautiful youth, the son and heir of the Emperor Michael. but the throne of Constantinople was shaken by a revolution. The imperial family of Ducas was confined to the palace or the cloister, and Robert deplored and resented the disgrace of his daughter and the expulsion of his ally. A Greek, who styled himself the father of Constantine, soon appeared at Salerno and related the adventures of his fall and flight. That unfortunate friend was acknowledged by the Duke and adorned with the pomp and titles of imperial dignity. In his triumphal progress through Apulia and Calabria, Michael was saluted with the tears and acclamations of the people, and Pope Gregory VII exhorted the bishops to preach and the Catholics to fight in the pious work of his restoration. His conversations with Robert were frequent and familiar, and their mutual promises were justified by the valor of the Normans and the treasures of the East. Yet this Michael, by the confession of the Greeks and Latins, was a pageant and an impostor. A monk who had fled from his convent, or a domestic who had served in the palace. The fraud had been contrived by the subtle Giscard, and he trusted that after this pretender had given a decent color to his arms, he would sink at the nod of the conqueror into his primitive obscurity. But victory was the only argument that could determine the belief of the Greeks, and the ardor of the Latins was much inferior to their credulity. The Norman veterans wished to enjoy the harvest of their toils, and the unwarlike Italians trembled at the known and unknown dangers of a transmarine expedition. In his new levies, Robert exerted the influence of gifts and promises, the terrors of civil and ecclesiastical authority. And some acts of violence might justify the reproach that age and infancy were pressed without distinction into the service of their unrelenting prince. After 2 years' incessant preparations, the land and naval forces were assembled at Otranto, at the heel or extreme promontory of Italy, and Robert was accompanied by his wife, who fought by his side, his son Bohemond, and the representative of the Emperor Michael. 1,300 knights of Norman race or discipline formed the sinews of the army, which might be swelled to 30,000 followers of every denomination. The men, the horses, the arms, the engines, the wooden towers, covered with raw hides, were embarked on board 150 vessels. The transports had been built in the ports of Italy, and the galleys were supplied by the alliance of the Republic of Ragusa. At the mouth of the Adriatic Gulf, the shores of Italy and Epirus incline towards each other. The space between Brundusium and Durazzo, the Roman passage, is no more than 100 miles. At the last station of Otranto, it is contracted to 50. And this narrow distance had suggested to Pyrrhus and Pompey the sublime or extravagant idea of a bridge. Before the general embarkation, the Norman Duke dispatched Bohemond with 15 galleys to seize or threaten the Isle of Corfu, to survey the opposite coast, and to secure a harbour in the neighbourhood of Valona for the landing of the troops. They passed and landed without perceiving an enemy, and this successful experiment displayed the neglect and decay of the naval power of the Greeks. The islands of Epirus and the maritime towns were subdued by the arms or the name of Robert, who led his fleet and army from Corfu. I use the modern appellation. To the siege of Durazzo. That city, the western key of the empire, was guarded by ancient renown and recent fortifications, by George Palaeologus, a patrician, victorious in the Oriental Wars, and a numerous garrison of Albanians and Macedonians, who in every age have maintained the character of soldiers. In the prosecution of his enterprise, the courage of Giscard was assailed by every form of danger and mischance. In the most propitious season of the year, as his fleet passed along the coast, a storm of wind and snow unexpectedly arose. The Adriatic was swelled by the raging blast of the south, and a new shipwreck confirmed the old infamy of the Acroceraunian rocks. The sails, the masts, and the oars were shattered or torn away. The sea and shore were covered with the fragments of vessels, with arms and dead bodies, and the greatest part of the provisions were either drowned or damaged. The ducal galley was laboriously rescued from the waves, and Robert halted 7 days on the adjacent cape to collect the relics of his loss and revive the drooping spirits of his soldiers. The Normans were no longer the bold and experienced mariners who had explored the ocean from Greenland to Mount Atlas and who smiled at the petty dangers of the Mediterranean. They had wept during the tempest. They were alarmed by the hostile approach of the Venetians, who had been solicited by the prayers and promises of the Byzantine court. The first day's action was not disadvantageous to Bohemond, a beardless youth who led the naval powers of his father. All night the galleys of the Republic lay on their anchors in the form of a crescent, and the victory of the second day was decided by the dexterity of their evolutions, the station of their archers, the weight of their javelins, and the borrowed aid of the Greek fire. The Apulian and Ragusian vessels fled to the shore. Several were cut from their cables and dragged away by the conqueror, and a sally from the town carried slaughter and dismay to the tents of the Norman duke. A seasonable relief was poured into Durazzo, and as soon as the besiegers had lost the command of the sea, the islands and maritime towns withdrew from the camp the supply of tribute and provision. That camp was soon afflicted with a pestilential disease. 500 knights perished by an inglorious death, and the list of burials, if all could obtain a decent burial, amounted to 10,000 persons. Under these calamities, the mind of Giscard alone was firm and invincible, and while he collected new forces from Apulia and Italy, he battered or scaled or sapped the walls of Durazzo. But his industry and valor were encountered by equal valor and more perfect industry. A movable turret of a size and capacity to contain 500 soldiers had been rolled forwards to the foot of the rampart, but the descent of the dorm, or drawbridge, was checked by an enormous beam, and the wooden structure was constantly consumed by artificial flames. While the Roman Empire was attacked by the Turks in the east and the Normans in the west, the aged successor of Michael surrendered the scepter to the hands of Alexius, an illustrious captain and the founder of the Comnenian dynasty. The Princess Anne, his daughter and historian, observes in her affected style that even Hercules was unequal to a double combat, and on the principle she approves a hasty peace with the Turks, which allowed her father to undertake in person the relief of Durazzo. On his accession, Alexius found the camp without soldiers and the treasury without money. Yet such were the vigor and activity of his measures that in 6 months he assembled an army of 70,000 men and performed a march of 500 miles. His troops were levied in Europe and Asia from Peloponnesus to the Black Sea. His majesty was displayed in the silver arms and rich trappings of the companies of horse guards, and the emperor was attended by a train of nobles and princes, some of whom, in rapid succession, had been clothed with the purple, and were indulged by the lenity of the times in a life of affluence and dignity. Their youthful ardor might animate the multitude, but their love of pleasure and contempt of subordination were pregnant with disorder and mischief, and their importunate clamors for speedy and decisive action disconcerted the prudence of Alexius, who might have surrendered and starved the besieging army. The enumeration of provinces recalls a sad comparison of the past and present limits of the Roman world. The raw levies were drawn together in haste and terror, and the garrisons of Anatolia, or Asia Minor, had been purchased by the evacuation of the cities which were immediately occupied by the Turks. The strength of the Greek army consisted in the Varangians, the Scandinavian guards, whose numbers were recently augmented by a colony of exiles and volunteers from the British island of Thule. Under the yoke of the Norman conqueror, the Danes and English were oppressed and united, a band of adventurous youths resolved to desert a land of slavery. The sea was open to their escape, and in their long pilgrimage they visited every coast that afforded any hope of liberty and revenge. They were entertained in the service of the Greek emperor, and their first station was in a new city on the Asiatic shore. But Alexius soon recalled them to the defense of his person and palace, and bequeathed to his successors the inheritance of their faith and valor. The name of a Norman invader revived the memory of their wrongs. They marched with alacrity against the national foe and panted to regain in Epirus the glory which they had lost in the Battle of Hastings. The Varangians were supported by some companies of Franks or Latins, and the rebels who had fled to Constantinople from the tyranny of Giscard were eager to signalize their zeal and gratify their revenge. In this emergency, the emperor had not disdained the impure aid of the Paulicians, or Manichaeans of Thrace and Bulgaria. And these heretics united with the patience of martyrdom the spirit and discipline of active valor. The treaty with the Sultan had procured a supply of some 1,000 Turks, and the arrows of the Scythian horse were opposed to the lances of the Norman cavalry. On the report and distant prospect of these formidable numbers, Robert assembled a council of his principal officers. "You behold," said he, "your danger. It is urgent and inevitable. The hills are covered with arms and standards, and the emperor of the Greeks is accustomed to wars and triumphs. Obedience and union are our only safety, and I am ready to yield the command to a more worthy leader." The vote and acclamation even of his secret enemies assured him in that perilous moment of their esteem and confidence, and the Duke thus continued, "Let us trust in the rewards of victory, and deprive cowardice of the means of escape. Let us burn our vessels and our baggage, and give battle on this spot as if it were the place of our nativity and our burial." The resolution was unanimously approved, and without confining himself to his lines, Giscard awaited in battle array the nearest approach of the enemy. His rear was covered by a small river, his right wing extended to the sea, his left to the hills. Nor was he conscious, perhaps, that on the same ground Caesar and Pompey had formerly disputed the empire of the world. Against the advice of his wisest captains, Alexius resolved to risk the event of a general action, and exhorted the garrison of Durazzo to assist their own deliverance by a well-timed sally from the town. He marched in two columns to surprise the Normans before daybreak on two different sides. His light cavalry was scattered over the plain. The archers formed the second line, and the Varangians claimed the honors of the vanguard. In the first onset, the battle axes of the strangers made a deep and bloody impression on the army of Giscard, which was now reduced to 15,000 men. The Lombards and Calabrians ignominiously turned their backs. They fled towards the river and the sea, but the bridge had been broken down to check the sally of the garrison, and the coast was lined with the Venetian galleys who played their engines among the disorderly throng. On the verge of ruin, they were saved by the spirit and conduct of their chiefs. Gaeta, the wife of Robert, is painted by the Greeks as a warlike Amazon, a second Pallas, less skillful in art, but not less terrible in arms than the Athenian goddess. Though wounded by an arrow, she stood her ground and strove by her exhortation and example to rally the flying troops. Her female voice was seconded by the more powerful voice and arm of the Norman Duke, as calm in action as he was magnanimous in counsel. "Whither," he cried aloud, "whither do ye fly? Your enemy is implacable, and death is less grievous than servitude." The moment was decisive. As the Varangians advanced before the line, they discovered the nakedness of their flanks. The main battle of the Duke, of 800 knights, stood firm and entire. They couched their lances, and the Greeks deplore the furious and irresistible shock of the French cavalry. Alexius was not deficient in the duties of a soldier or a general, but he no longer beheld the slaughter of the Varangians and the flight of the Turks. Then he despised his subjects and despaired of his fortune. The Princess Anne, who drops a tear on this melancholy event, is reduced to praise the strength and swiftness of her father's horse, and his vigorous struggle when he was almost overthrown by the stroke of a lance which had shivered the imperial helmet. His desperate valor broke through a squadron of Franks who opposed his flight, and after wandering 2 days and as many nights in the mountains, he found some repose of body, though not of mind, in the walls of Lychnidus. The victorious Robert reproached the tardy and feeble pursuit which had suffered the escape of so illustrious a prize. But he consoled his disappointment by the trophies and standards of the field, the wealth and luxury of the Byzantine camp, and the glory of defeating an army 5 times more numerous than his own. A multitude of Italians had been the victims of their own fears, but only 30 of his knights were slain in this memorable day. In the Roman host, the loss of Greeks, Turks, and English amounted to 5,000 or 6,000. The plain of Durazzo was stained with noble and royal blood, and the end of the impostor Michael was more honorable than his life. It is more than probable that Giscard was not afflicted by the loss of a costly pageant, which had merited only the contempt and derision of the Greeks. After their defeat, they still persevered in the defense of Durazzo, and a Venetian commander supplied the place of George Palaeologus, who had been imprudently called away from his station. The tents of the besiegers were converted into barracks to sustain the inclemency of the winter, and in answer to the defiance of the garrison, Robert insinuated that his patience was at least equal to their obstinacy. Perhaps he already trusted to his secret correspondence with a Venetian noble, who sold the city for a rich and honorable marriage. At the dead of night, several rope ladders were dropped from the walls. The light Calabrians ascended in silence, and the Greeks were awakened by the name and trumpets of the conqueror. Yet they defended the streets 3 days against an enemy already master of the rampart. And yet 7 months elapsed between the first investment and the final surrender of the place. From Durazzo, the Norman duke advanced into the heart of Epirus, or Albania, traversed the first mountains of Thessaly, surprised 300 English in the city of Castoria, approached Thessalonica, and made Constantinople tremble. A more pressing duty suspended the prosecution of his ambitious designs. By shipwreck, pestilence, and the sword, his army was reduced to 1/3 of the original numbers, and instead of being recruited from Italy, he was informed by plaintive epistles of the mischiefs and dangers which had been produced by his absence. The revolt of the cities and barons of Apulia, the distress of the Pope, and the approach or invasion of Henry, King of Germany. Highly presuming that his person was sufficient for the public safety, he repassed the sea in a single brigantine and left the remains of the army under the command of his son and the Norman counts, exhorting Bohemond to respect the freedom of his peers and the counts to obey the authority of their leader. The son of Giscard trod in the footsteps of his father, and the two destroyers are compared by the Greeks to the caterpillar and the locust, the last of whom devours whatever has escaped the teeth of the former. After winning 2 battles against the emperor, he descended into the plain of Thessaly and besieged Larissa, the fabulous realm of Achilles, which contained the treasure and magazines of the Byzantine camp. Yet a just praise must not be refused to the fortitude and prudence of Alexius, who bravely struggled with the calamities of the times. In the poverty of the state, he presented